We have arrived at the end of the week, the end of the month, almost the end of the campaign. Where does, do you suppose, this economy stand, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 30th day of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I could do a setup here, something about 4 days left till voting ends, big week in this economy, blah, blah, blah. Or we could just get right to it, which is what we are going to do. Heather Long is at The Washington Post. David Gura is at MSNBC. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, so David, I want to start with you, and I want to do just a quick once-over on gross domestic product, which, of course, came out this week. And I want to skip the whole 33% annualized, 7.5% for the quarter. And I would like a little prognostication out of you as we stand here on the cusp of this election. What is Q4 going to look like?
I think the numbers can be way lower than the one you just mentioned, way lower than 33%. And I think a reason for that is that number, 33.1% in terms of annualized growth, was boosted so much by the stimulus that we had, by the economy opening in as partial a way as it did. There's a lot of work to be done. I'm quoting some economists who said that this week when it comes to the next quarter. And there are so many X factors kind of weighing on growth as we look ahead. Certainly, the virus is the main one. We're seeing all of these records being broken as this pandemic continues to be a huge problem in this country and a huge drag on the economy. Obviously, there are mitigation measures associated with that, you know, if we have to mitigate more, could hurt the economy even more going forward. That's something to keep in mind. And then there's the stimulus. The stimulus that we had passed in its earlier iterations did help the economy in the last quarter get back onto its feet a bit. Obviously, nothing has happened in Congress. Their lawmakers have returned home to their districts to watch the election results, as we all will be on Tuesday. And, you know, there's some hope that Congress will get its act together when they get back. But that hasn't happened yet. And that's certainly something that we're going to be watching and wondering about as we move ahead here and look at the prospects for growth.
Heather, two things about what David said. Number one, the stimulus that we had, which is to say it is long gone. Item number two, Mitch McConnell apparently said today or in the last day or two, yeah, I think a stimulus plan is what we're going to take up in the new year. And it made me think of a tweet you had this morning about ExxonMobil keeping its dividend, but laying people off. And you said, you want a K-shaped recovery indicator? This is it, man.
Yeah, that's a big signal here that layoffs keep happening. ExxonMobil is going to lay off 15% of its workforce. That's larger, pretty much the largest number they've ever done. And in terms of the K-shaped recovery, it's been interesting. Both that company as well as companies like Hertz, JCPenney, Neiman Marcus, right before they declared bankruptcy, they were paying out huge bonuses to their executives and then turning around and doing more layoffs. And so it's just hard to imagine this very different picture for people at the top versus the bottom 50% changing anytime soon.
David, this is going to sound like a flip question, but I actually mean it because there are people who pay attention to this stuff. Do you suppose it's possible that this recession is technically over?
I don't think so, personally. And I think there's a lot of talk about there being a double dip recession. We could see it go down more or again here in the coming weeks and months. I think we all just have to keep in mind how strange this downturn has been. You hear that a lot from economists and policymakers. There was a very memorable quotation by Ron Wyden, the senator, in a piece by Jim Tankersley and Gina Smilek, who's on the show with you from time to time. And he said, you know, this isn't your grandpa's recession. This isn't your grandfather's type of recession. And such a good point. I mean, we're dealing with such new terrain here as we have been for the last 9 months. And I'll say it again, over and over again, this is so tied to the way this virus progresses. And, you know, I think that the president would be very eager to say that we're out of the woods with the GDP number that we got this week. I was struck as there's so much talk about there being, again, this K-shaped bump where we have some people doing well and some not doing well. The president and his economic advisors aren't just talking about this mythic V-shaped recovery. They're talking about a super V now.
Oh,
and again, that's so far afield from what you're hearing from serious economists who are looking again at this strange economy that we're living with right now.
I apologize for my outburst. I had not heard Super V.
I think that was Kudlow, but I don't want to say that with total certainty, but one of the gang advising the president of the economy.
I would put money on it being Kudlow. I mean, that's his thing, right? A V-shaped recovery. Heather, let me ask you this. If Congress turns completely Democratic and if Joe Biden wins the White House, there will be a push for a stimulus plan as soon as they possibly can in January. I wonder what you think, though, of moves by the Republicans, which we have already seen, to start enforcing austerity in this economy, that we're simply spending too much money. What will that do to a recovery?
Well, that's definitely going to be the Republican playbook if there's a blue wave. But if Democrats control the Senate, we're going to get that stimulus. And so I think there's less of a concern that you would see that kind of stymie that we saw coming out of the Great Recession, where there was a block for doing more stuff. You know, if the Democrats control it, they're going to push. They're going to push through. You know, the question, I think you're right, is can people hold on until then? A lot of those protections for evictions and protections for student loan debt, they roll off at the end of the year. So does extra unemployment aid. So people who have exhausted their unemployment insurance already and still can't find a job are transitioning to this extra program that was approved by Congress in March. That ends basically right after Christmas. So what's going to happen in January? Can people wait till the 20th?
Super quick. We got like 35, 40 seconds left. So in five words or less, we're going to an old standby. There's a Fed meeting next week, Wednesday, Thursday. Five words or less. David Gura, what is Jay Powell thinking?
Stay steady.
Come on, man. You're crumbling under pressure. Stay steady. I'll take two.
Okay, yeah.
Stay steady.
Yeah,
five words or less.
Stay steady. That's five words or less. If it's more or less, stay steady.
That's right. Okay, stay steady. Heather, over to you.
I think he's thinking, I'm the last man standing, and why?
Oh, man.
She can have one of my words. She can have one of my five.
All right.
But if we're in a situation where there's no clear winner, and obviously it looks like we're not going to get more stimulus, which he has been begging for, that puts the Fed, which already is almost out of ammunition, in a really tough spot.
Jay Powell, the last man standing in this economy, trying to take care of it. All right. Heather Long at The Washington Post, David Gura at MSNBC. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Super V. I hadn't heard that one before. On Wall Street today, the month and the week end with a sell-off. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The economic data of the day came to us from the Commerce Department this morning. Its monthly report on personal income and personal spending, both up. Better, actually, than you would expect here as we are in the fall of this pandemic. A lot of it traces back to the stimulus that we had, as David and Heather were talking about. Not up, though. Down, in fact, for the fifth month in a row, the personal savings rate. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains what's going on there.
Back in the spring, Andy, who didn't want us to use his last name, says his family was socking away cash. They got a $2,900 government relief check, saved most of that. He estimates altogether they saved
maybe somewhere between like $5,000 and $7,000. I mean, we weren't really going out to eat or anything, and we were pretty much hunkered down.
Those savings will come in handy now. Andy's in the retail business. With all the store closings, he's taking home less money, and he's not the only one. So it makes sense that, according to the Commerce Department, the personal savings rate, that is, the percentage of our disposable income that we save, is down, way down.
Gosh, it's less than half what the savings rate was during the pandemic peak.
That's Beth Ann Bovino, U.S. Chief Economist at S&P Global, which is a marketplace underwriter. She says the savings rate plummeted from around 33% last April, the highest rate since the government started keeping track, to about 14% last month. Bovino says that's partly because people bought more stuff, cars, home office equipment, but also there haven't been any more government relief payments.
That surge in government transfers was largely in April, and then it spiked in June, and now it has ended for many households.
Then the extra $600 a week federal unemployment payment stopped over the summer. Bill Bynum is CEO of Hope Credit Union, based in Jackson, Mississippi. He says now some of his customers don't have any income to save. In fact, they can't even pay their bills.
After the end of July into August, and we're really starting to see an uptick in delinquencies and people struggling to make ends meet.
Bynum says about a third of their borrowers have had trouble making payments. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We told you about this at the beginning of the month, I think, when the jobs report came out and showed something like 850,000 women had left the labor force in September, four times the rate of men. A lot of the industries slammed by the layoffs, hospitality and retail, to name just a couple, are dominated by women. And even women who can work disproportionately bear the childcare and homeschooling burden in families. And that gets us to this. Women's participation in the American labor force has fallen to its lowest level since the late 1980s. And a new report from the Century Foundation and the Center for American Progress lays out what that is going to cost in dollars and otherwise. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Figuring out childcare has always been a struggle for James Cox. Before the pandemic, she was working crazy hours in two jobs as a restaurant server and a project manager for a nonprofit in Oakland, California.
And now with COVID, it's like, okay, everything is just turned upside down.
Schools are closed. The friends she used to lean on to watch her five-year-old daughter aren't available. She's lost most of her work, but she can't really take new jobs because of the childcare situation. American women could end up losing $64.5 billion a year in earnings, says Julie Cashin, a senior fellow with the Century Foundation.
This is not an individual family problem. This is an everybody problem.
Researchers based their estimate on analysis of federal data from April at the height of lockdowns. Since then, labor force participation among women has barely budged, even as more men have returned to work. And Titan Alon, an economist at UC San Diego, says dropping out can have consequences far beyond the current crisis.
You know, you kind of miss those stepping stones, you miss those career progression opportunities, and then when you come back, you're sort of less valuable to an employer.
Natalie Wright is afraid of that. The biology professor at Kenyon College in Ohio is managing to teach part-time despite being home with two kids after losing their spot in daycare. But she worries the slowdown in her research will be disastrous for her career.
It makes me feel terrified about whether I will get tenure, and I am the family's primary breadwinner.
In the absence of policies to address these disparities, the report says the drop in women's earnings could slow economic recovery. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Monday morning and every morning, actually during the week, check out the Marketplace Morning Report. All you need to know to get yourself set for your economic day. When you've got an audience mostly trapped at home, desperate for something to kill time, maybe offer a little escapism, which is, by the way, your stock in trade, what do? Well, you raise prices, of course. See also Netflix. The standard plan is going up $1 a month to $14. The premium plan is going up $2, $18 a month. Basic, still $9. But prices aren't the only things changing at the streaming behemoth. Lots more original content, yes. Lots more original cancellations, too. Marketplace Jasmine Garst has that one.
If you've been watching a lot of Netflix lately, you might have noticed more Netflix originals.
Men are going to come along and want to teach you things. Doesn't make them any smarter.
That's The Queen's Gambit, about a chess prodigy. It makes sense for Netflix to pump money into content creation given the increasingly competitive streaming landscape, says Tim Hanlon, analyst at the Verter Group.
That's sort of a classic new media launching textbook approach. Find something that is either exclusive or create things that are original and exclusive to you that can't be found anywhere else.
But for every hit like Stranger Things, there's dozens of Netflix originals that aren't as successful, like Altered Carbon.
I was brought back against my will, but I am an envoy. I take what is offered.
After season two, the show was offered nothing. It got axed, as did wrestling drama Glow and political comedy The Patriot Act. Insiders say increasingly at Netflix, three seasons is a good run, and more than that is a hit. Pedro Fejeda focuses on information systems at Carnegie Mellon University. He says this is because more than ever, Netflix is making its decisions based on hard data.
It's all about data these days, not just in recommending stuff, but also then in producing the stuff.
It's not just about how many people watch, but how many new people and for how long. Gary Rosenson with GR Media Advisor says cancellations may anger fans, but that won't affect Netflix.
they know they're still going to be a staple. That's what they're banking on because they have so much content.
It also helps that the pandemic and winter are sending people back indoors. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I made myself a sign. I love it. It was worth every penny.
A sound investment. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 157 points today, 0.5%, 26,501. The NASDAQ down 274 points. That is 2.4% there, 10,911. The S&P 500 down 40 points, about 1.2%, 3269. So, all y'all know how I feel about pumpkin spice, right? Not a fan. Pumpkins this time of year, as in the real ones, though, for carving, which is what they're good for, on average, they will cost you about the same as last year. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, pumpkins this month are running about 45 cents a pound compared to 44 cents a pound last year. And store ads for pumpkins, well, they make up about 8% of overall vegetable ads compared with potatoes, 12% of ads. Now you know. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We talked about the dollar a little bit yesterday, why it matters globally and what happens when it swings in value as it has been doing in this pandemic. Today, why the dollar fluctuates so much. First of all, and this might sound obvious, but it is backed by the biggest economy in the world, which makes it
the safe haven.
Safe haven currency.
It serves as a safe haven.
In
times of global turmoil.
When there is so much uncertainty.
In times of uncertainty.
That was Tarek Hassan at Boston University, Susan Pozo at Western Michigan, and Viral Acharya at NYU Stern School of Business, economists, all three.
The pandemic created a huge wave of uncertainty, including in the minds of the central banks and other investors of the world. And they all basically wanted to hold dollar assets. And as a result, the scramble for dollars became strong.
Viral Acharya there, that strong scramble he mentioned sent the dollar to a three-year high back in March, which gets us to point number two, trust.
It does serve as a stable place relative to the rest of the world. And when we speak about stable, it's not just that the dollar is stable, but that the economy is stable.
Susan Pozo on that one. This economy is stable for a lot of reasons. The rule of law, sensible regulation, and a tradition of understanding its role in the global economy. But as Viral Acharya points out,
I have no doubt that the status of the United States as a safe haven, while presently still intact, is being increasingly questioned.
We are still, to be clear, a ways from the dollar being replaced as the reserve global currency or it not being what people turn to when they want a safe haven. But the dollar's value is a window into how the world thinks the U.S. is doing.
We have lots of things to worry about. A raging pandemic, wildfires, hurricanes, a tense election. I'm more worried about the effects of erratic foreign policy.
What our policy has been in the last few years, to get out of international accords, to break up the trade agreements that we have.
In general, stability of the United States policy as a global bellwether, the way its position has been somewhat shaken over the last few years.
Our thanks to Tarek Hassan at Boston University, Susan Pozo at Western Michigan, also Viral Acharya at NYU's Stern School of Business. The dollar today, by the way, down at or near its pandemic lows against the euro, the British pound, and the Japanese yen. Thing is, with virus counts rising here and globally, which is not great economically, as David Gura was saying, maybe people are going to be looking for a safe haven again. Among the many unprecedented things about this election cycle, many unprecedented things, one of them is the amount of money being spent, $14 billion by one estimate on races up and down the ballot. Millions of Americans contributed to the candidate or the campaign of their choice, but the dollar figures don't quite capture how much people are spending of their most valuable currency. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains that one.
On a gray and overcast Saturday morning in St. Louis, rather than being at home on his couch with a hot cup of coffee, Will Stevens is the lone occupant of a mostly empty outdoor stall at Soulard Farmers Market. Some confused visitors, passing stalls selling beer glasses and baskets and kettle corn, peer at his large sign reading The Notary Project and try to give him donations.
We don't take donations. We don't take money to notarize the ballots. We're just doing it as a public service. So.
It's in the mid-40s and Stevens forgot his gloves, so he's keeping his hands warm in his pockets while he waits for anyone to come by. Anyone who might need their election ballot envelope notarized. Stevens and his wife both signed up to become notaries just for this election and are working with about a dozen others to provide the service.
I'm always looking for opportunities where your time is more valuable than the money that you could contribute.
In response to the COVID-19 pandemic, the Missouri legislature expanded who could vote absentee and added the new category of mail-in ballots for other voters. Missouri Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft says the legislation was so rushed, it created a problem. Mail-in ballots have to be notarized, and even though that only costs a couple of dollars...
Under Missouri law, it was not legal for a Missouri notary to charge for notarizing an absentee ballot. When they created the new law for the mail-in ballots, they did not include a prohibition like that.
So he put out the call for existing notaries to volunteer the service, and hundreds did. Others, like Stevens and Jill Anderson, who usually works as a cancer research coordinator, signed up just to increase access.
I think that the process in Missouri is needlessly and potentially intentionally difficult.
I spotted Anderson at a picnic table outside a local restaurant, prepared with her notary book, a big sign, and a little American flag. She figures she spent 60 to 70 hours notarizing ballot envelopes and about $100.
And that included my supplies, the book and the stamp. You have to get a bond. And then beyond that, it's, you know, time, effort. I made myself a sign. I love it. It was worth every penny.
That sign made it easy for Cynthia Barunas of St. Louis to spot her.
Yeah, I came here intentionally today because there was a listing posted of notary events. So I'm super grateful to everybody who put all the work into keeping that updated.
Anderson checks Barunas' ID, confirms her address.
And then you can go ahead and seal the ballot in the envelope. I've got sticky stuff.
All right.
So you don't have to lick it. So I don't need to see the ballot.
Right.
And she wields her trusty notary stamp. Anderson says she's notarized more than 150 envelopes with ballots for the November election. Things were a little slower for Will Stevens at Soulard Market. He says the Notary Project has helped more than 100 people get their ballots ready to mail, some at notary house calls, which they made on their own time, although there were a few unneeded trips.
One was a military overseas ballot that didn't actually need to be notarized, and the other one was a person who was voting absentee, and that ballot didn't need to be notarized as well.
Steven says he doesn't mind. He has the time and his car gets good gas mileage. He's just hoping that by the time the next election rolls around, voting in Missouri will be a bit easier for everyone. In St. Louis, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the acknowledgement that Halloween this year is going to be different, but that people are still going to want to dress up. So, from S&P Global Market Intelligence, this costume data, seaborne imports, that is, coming in on container ships. I know you know what it means, but seaborne is tough on the radio. Anyway, Halloween costume imports this year via ship, down a bit more than 7.2% from a year earlier, especially not popular. Zombie costumes, imports down almost 43%. Vampires down 20%. Shocking, I know, that nobody wants more scary things in the middle of a pandemic. All right, we got to go, but here is your Friday moment of, well, It's not economic context as much as it is market trivia. Since 1960, the S&P 500 has correctly guessed or predicted or anticipated, take your pick, the winner of the presidential election. The mechanics go like this. If from August to the end of October, the S&P is up, the incumbent party wins. If from August to end October, the S&P is down, the challenger's party wins. Has held true every 4 years since 1960. Today, the end of October, the S&P 500 finished 1.1 points below where it was 3 months ago. So Joe Biden wins, I guess. BJ Lederman did the music. Nancy Fargali produces the show. Nancy Cassett directs news. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have a great weekend. Oh, yeah, this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.